Blog Talk Radio.
And tonight we present a discussion on Princess Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils, which was actually the Phoenician version of Babylonian Ishtar's descent into the underworld to resurrect the dying god. In her case, this was Tammuz. In our case, Baal-Hadad. Now, we've used this obviously fact-based legend to reconstruct Anath's vanquishing the Lord of Death at autumn equinox to revive Prince Baal, the rain and vegetation god of ancient Canaan. Now, if you're wondering about where the head of John the Baptist comes into this, well, we'll solve that mystery also. Now, our special guest tonight for this program will be Frater Heracles of our Austin, Texas Lodge, who just presented a spectacular Festival of Seven Gates celebration and will give us his firsthand impressions of this revived ancient rite and how it is done in the 21st century. So if you want to know where the Dance of the Seven Veils started and is still going, tune in and chat with us. Down and down the path we go to the caverns far below. Now, Princess Salome, as those of you who are familiar with this, and most of us are, remember, was the daughter of King Herod of Judea at the time of first century, the time of John the Baptist and Jesus, and that during that period. Now, a little background on that. Herod was a Judean king of the royal line at the time, and Judea at that time, as we remember, was a Roman protectorate or province. And in fact, the Romans ran it and collected the taxes and policed it. However, they had just as Cyrus the Persian had when the Second Temple was built, they essentially had control of the country. And it was what we would call today a satellite of the Roman Empire. And they wanted King Herod to handle the civil and religious end of things, and so they were the power behind the throne, in a sense, were the Romans. And Herod was not particularly liked. That story about Herod or Herod's father sending out all of the to kill all the babies born in the year that Jesus was born, probably apocryphal, but Herod was not particularly liked, but he was a Jewish king, and so this is his position. And he lived rather opulently, and he was not, he and his household were not what you'd call austere Orthodox Jews by a long shot. However, this business of Salome, his daughter, the princess, doing the dance of the seven veils for the head of John the Baptist is a very strange, unrealistically motivated story. The seven veils, obviously, the dance of the seven veils is obviously a ritualistic rite, and Princess Salome is obviously performing some sort of a ritualistic rite in doing this. But the idea that she would do this and ask for the head of John the Baptist in return for entertaining her father with this dance is really very, very, this is quite a strain as far as plot motivation in the story is concerned. So we are not the only ones to suspect that there is something else behind this story. And so quite frankly, the reality of it would be that Princess Salome was in fact you would call her a priestess of the goddess Astarte, yeah, that's what we think. And also, that's what the novelist Tom Robbins, you remember he wrote Jitterbug Perfume, and he also wrote a novel in 1990, he came out with a novel called Skinny Legs and All, which was, you know, we started using Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils in 1974, so I'm not saying that Tom got the idea from us, but in 1990 he came out with this novel, Skinny Legs and All, in which he said the same thing, that Salome was a priestess of Astarte. And this is pretty obvious, and it's also obvious that this is the Canaanite, ancient Canaanite Phoenician version of Ishtar's descent into the underworld. You know, Ishtar goes down into the underworld. That's over in Babylon. She goes down into the underworld to rescue and revive her lover, Tammuz. And she leaves a piece of jewelry at each one of the gates as she goes down. And then she finally confronts, in their case, the Lady of Death. In our case, the Lord of Death in Canaan. But Ishtar ends up naked at the bottom, so all she's been wearing is jewelry. Now, in our case, Salome has seven veils, and we don't say she ends up naked, but at least she gives up her seven veils, one to each planet on the way down. So she's actually, in the sense, this is a symbolic Kabbalistic descent, and then she resurrects her your king, who lies dead she does this at autumn equinox. And so Salome, now, as far as John, the head of John the Baptist is concerned, there's no, as I said, there's no reason why Princess Salome would have any interest in the head of a crazy old, dirty old coot-eating locusts out in the desert. Why would she have any desire for his head? That doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense if John the Baptist was also connected with the ancient Canaanite cult, especially the worship of El, Father El, which Jesus quite probably was also connected to. So the implication here is that she wanted his head to make a ritual chalice from the skull. And this was similar to the ritual chalice that had been made from Melchizedek's skull. And in fact, there is a sect, there was a sect, an ancient sect, who did have the idea that John the Baptist was made into a skull cup. And some people even consider that that may be the Baphomet of the Templars, you know. That's what she's dancing for is, old John's already dead, but she wants his head because she wants, she's doing the dance, she wants to have the head as a ritual goblet, perpetuating and the memory of a great prophet of the tradition. See? Okay. Now we have Frater Heracles on the line, and he just oversaw and presented a wonderful version of our Dance of Seven Veils, our Festival of Seven Gates, in Austin, Texas. And this is, you know, this was, this, we started in 1974. We haven't missed one since. So, John, are you on there? You want to tell us about your ceremony and how it went?
Tare, Frater Thabian, Nasca Te Ipsum. How are you?
Well, I'm about out of wind here, and I'm going to let you take over. So tell us about how it went, and especially the beautiful costumes. I know your pictures that you sent were just absolutely awesome. So give us a rundown on how Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils plays out in down there in Texas.
Well, we had about 25 people show up, and probably about 10 of those people were brand new, invited by friends and members of the Austin chapter of the OTA. And they all showed up about 7:30 on September 20th, and we had set up the hinge and got everything ready, and we're waiting for darkness to fall so that we can do everything by tiki torch light and candle light and everything like that. And we got before everybody got here, we had a field and vine and the actors show up for a run-through rehearsal, which with these types of, especially the Seven Gates, there's a lot of physical locations that the actors of the ritual have to perform and guide people through the ritual. So we went through a couple of rehearsals, and it really, really helped going through a run-through with people that were playing roles that, you know, hadn't played these parts before. They're relatively new initiates, and they came in and they went through the rehearsal, and once we went through it once, they realized how complex it is, and they're like, oh, we need to do it again. So once we had the rehearsals done and the lights got low and we lit up the torches and everybody robed up into their black robes, and we had members Jordan Rowland and Will Morris go out and set up a musical place outside where Jordan, both Jordan and Will are master musicians, and Jordan set up his electrical guitar set up with an amplifier and a pedal, you know, guitar pedals and everything out there, and Will is a master jazz musician, and he brought his flute and Tibetan singing bowls, and you know, he brought a 28-inch gong. I told him, like, you know, you don't need to worry about bringing your gong. I've got a 16-inch gong. He's like, well, I've got a 28-inch gong, and I'm like, well, I guess a bigger gong is better than a smaller gong. So the rumor has it, you know. So we decided to wake up the neighbors that night with the 28-inch gong, And they started playing this really soft, melodic music, and everybody gathered out on the porch outside. And under the torchlight, Odos came in, and it was played by Jeffrey Lee Contreras, who did a masterful job reading the Odos introduction to the rite. And if people are listening that have never taken part of the OTA seasonal festivals, if, with your permission, I'd like to read the Odos opening line so they kind of have like an idea of where we're going
That's a good idea. Well, yeah, why don't you go ahead and read the Odos, because that really introduces everything.
Yeah. So Jeff got out there, and Trader Knox, and he's wearing the long beak nose and the dark robe, and he's holding a torch, and he begins, and this nice melodic music is playing in the background, and he begins reading the Festival of Seven Gates at Autumn Equinox. The drama depicts the descent of Astarte into the underworld to vanquish the Dark Lord Mote and resurrect the Year King Baal, thus opening the fall season of rains on the western quadrant of the Magic Circle, which is ruled by the principle of water and the philosophical element of Mercury, symbolizing the process of solution. Second of the four primal operations of alchemy, accomplishing the reanimation of the spirit through the cycle of rebirth. Hearken unto the myth of the sacred year. It was written in the dawn of the age of Aries, in the years when Melchizedek was priest king in Salem, a tale older than the walls of Jericho, of how fair Astarte, queen of heaven, wept and mourned for Prince Baal, her consort, slain by the Dark Lord Mote, when all the world lay parched and withered under the torch of the gods at high summer. When she appeared unto the people at summer solstice, swearing an oath to vanquish the Lord of Death, milling and grinding and casting him into the field, she did also promise to revive Lord Baal, Cloud Rider, to rule again with the sun's return in winter season. And so she made the request of Father El, High King of all the gods, who reigns supreme upon the summit of Mount Zaphon, that he give her the Grail Chalice, filled with the golden elixir vitae of rebirth, so that she might carry it down through the spheres of the Holy Tree of Life into the caverns of the underworld, and there to confront the Lord of Death, forcing him to give up his hold on Prince Baal, the Thunderer. All-wise Father El did grant her the boon, on condition that she leave one of her seven veils, a color symbolizing the power of the sphere, at each of the celestial gates, on her descent as a token of sacrifice. Only the black veil of mystery would remain to clothe her when she faced the Dark Lord. And so began the sacred dance of the seven veils. So it was, so it is, and so shall it be. It sums it up as, we're doing an alchemical operation, and we're going through the spheres of the Tree of Life, and we're going into the Western. There's so much symbolism in this. It's really amazing. After Jeffrey had read the Odos part, he handed the torch over to Astarte, who stayed off in the side, who was played by Louise Black, who is a masterful fashion designer. Actually, you can see her on season 6 of Project Runway. She's pretty well known as a fashion designer, and she designed her own Astarte belly dancer's outfit, which was absolutely astonishing. She put so much work into it. The crown that she was wearing was made by Savannah Sky Smith, another member of ours. And so she just looked absolutely amazing as Astarte. And Louise ended up actually, after she had played the role, she posted her outfit up for sale on her Etsy.com, Louise Black at Etsy.com or something like that. And she sold it within 5 minutes because she was like, I did a seasonal ritual and this was the outfit I wore, and she sold it. And I was like, don't sell the outfit, we can use it again. And she's like, oh, I'll make another one. So, she did a masterful job leading. This ritual depends entirely upon the vine and field and Astarte working together. You know, they're going around, vine and field were played by Matthew Larner and Trish Ladish, and they did a masterful job getting in there and guiding the people, telling them their cues and when they should chant and where they should stand and where they should go, and they just did a wonderful job. So they the field and vine lead them out into the hinge away from where they had heard the Odos recite the introduction. And they get out there, and of course Odos comes back in and he reads the Orphic hymn to Pluto, and then he exits. And then we had Frater Sisyphus, who's Travis Swisher, came in, and he did the pentagram ritual and cast the circle and began the whole thing. Once the circle was cast, the vine, he pours a few drops of scented oil onto a lighted brazier, and he says, "An alchemistical solution, let mercury and ash unite, revive the purged and dormant spirit as the Athanor's flame burns bright." And what's really interesting about having the brazier on the altar, which has the you know, the Enneosphere on it. Enneosphere is the circles on the altar that connect all of the menhirs, or the hinge posts that represent the planets, to the center of that altar. And so the very act of uniting essential oil onto the flame, you know, let mercury and ash unite, you're telling everybody that this is an alchemical operation, and it's uniting the entire hinge to the central point of the focus of the altar there. And, you know, I think of quite a few shows back, Miss Jo Carson was saying that if you want to affect a greater area with the hinge and with the ritual energy that you're raising, you can bring in sacred items, sacred stones, and pieces of natural materials from a greater distance and bring them into the hinge and set them up around the hinge to affect a greater radius for the hinge rituals, which we did. We went out and collected river stones and got all kinds of stuff, you know, probably within a 15-mile radius, you know. So we were definitely affecting a very large segment of area with what we were doing. And we also have like several masterful magicians that are really able to encapsulate the role or to really get into the energies of it. So on top of having 25 people, you know, in the circle with this music and all these costumes, and doing a very, very powerful magical ritual, but also having a lot of fun doing it. It's a lot of fun going through this. I wish I could have seen the ritual, actually, because I was playing Bale and I was laid out on a coffin. I cut out a piece of plywood and painted it black, and it looked like a coffin top. And I painted a skull and crossbones on it. And I set that up on a bench, and I laid down on it and covered up with a sheet. So the whole time everybody's going through the ritual, I'm basically in a kind of a hoodwinked situation where I just don't see anything. I'm just hearing what's going on. And but there, as far as what I could hear, it was just really excellent. But excuse me. So they start when they invoke Astarte, and she comes in and she's like, "Let's descend down the hinge And so she takes them by the hand, and she's holding the Grail, and she hands the Grail to Field, and she hands the torch over to Vine, and Vine leads the circle by torchlight, and Astarte follows her, and Field's holding the cup, and then they get everybody ring around the Rosie, and they go around singing the chant, you know, down and down the path we go.
And to the caverns far below. down the path we go, to the caverns far below, westward toward the setting sun. Yeah, and yeah, where we'll bear the Holy Grail, and we're going to discuss the Holy Grail in relation to this next week, but in case anybody's wondering what we're doing with the Holy Grail, with the Canaanite ceremony.
It's interesting too that like we have eight menhirs set up, and one of them is Crotter, which represents the universe or the Milky Way, or even the celestial sign Crotter, and we skip Crotter because she's actually coming through Crotter, and we go straight to Saturn where she comes to the portal guard. And the portal guard, we had both male and female portal guards, and they were played by Michael and Jen, who started an encampment in Dallas. So they drove about 5 hours to come down and be a part of the ritual to play these roles. And if anybody's in Dallas is interested in joining what they're doing up there, then just contact us through the hermetics.ning.com, and we can get you in touch with them. But Astarte comes before the first gate, and she's standing in front of Saturn, and the portal guard stops her and says, "Who stands before the Saturnian gate? What power dost thou wield? What lord did send thee hither, and what payment dost thou yield?" And Astarte looks at her and says, "Behold, Astarte, queen of heaven, mother Asherat, shall clear the way. I am on my father's service. The veil of understanding shall I pay." And she takes a black veil and she hangs it onto the hook onto the menhir. Now, something really interesting happened to me while this was going on. One is that the planets, of course, correspond to the Sephira on the Tree of Life, and the black is Saturn, and what in your forthcoming book on Hermetic Yoga, you have you've designed these Hermetic Chakra roses for those spheres of the Tree of Life.
So get closer to the phone, John. Stay close to the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, on your forthcoming book on Hermetic Yoga, you've designed the Hermetic Master Ritual of Hermetic Caduceus, and there's these roses that you can visualize at each chakra. And so, as Bale and I'm laying under this sheet. When she got to the Saturnian Gate, I started focusing on the Saturn rose, which is a downward pointing black triangle with an indigo tau, which looks like a letter T, and it has pale yellow rose leaves around it. So I'm visualizing this, and when she put that veil on the menhir, my head started buzzing. I don't know what it was. It was just going zzz, 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 zzz. And then they go ring around the Rosie again, and they stop at the Jupiterian gate. Michael was standing at Jupiter, and he says, "Who stands before the Jovian gate? What power dost thou wield? What lord did send thee hither, and what payment dost thou yield?" And she says, "Behold, Astarte, queen of heaven, Lord Dagon shall clear the way. I am on my father's service. The veil of mercy shall I pay." And then while she's interacting with the Jupiter sphere, I'm visualizing the sphere of Jupiter with the Jupiterian rose, which is a blue triangle. Blue square turned on its side, so it looks like a diamond. And it has the orange flashing colors as the rose leaves, and the Phoenician letter Kaf on it, which is, I believe, scarlet. Is that right? Scarlet? Or And
Violet,
that's right. So it's a, it's a, and Deep Purple. And so and I'm visualizing a sky blue sphere in my head, and I see this this rose in front of me. And then I started, the energy just started getting more intense, and I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. And then I go ring around the rosy again to Mars, and then I start descending that ball down into my throat, you know, and it changes from sky blue into this deep red, and I see the pentagram in front of me with the Phoenician letter Pe, and the green petals of the roses around it, and all of a sudden, when she puts that red veil on at the Mars gate, my throat popped, and I started feeling this energy flow down from my head into my throat, and I started, you know, it was a very physical, tangible experience for me. It was like, this is actually how, you know, Baal is resurrected, you know, and I was going through that whole experience while they're going you know, around the hinge doing this. When we got to Sol, and we got to the sun, the solar sphere, I'm visualizing the universal hexagram and in gold, and the Phoenician letter Resh, and the sky blue roses and the golden ball. I'm just sitting there, and I'm sitting in my chest, you know, and it's just radiating out.
Oh, this is a wonderful. This is wonderful. I shouldn't admit this, but this is the first time though that I can doing, and you probably did too, is have a start to activate the psychic centers when she comes in there and finds Baal lying out there. But that for Baal himself to do this, this is terrific. We need to instruct all, and we need to instruct all our Baals from now on to do that meditation. That's a great idea.
This actually happened spontaneously because it was like I could. It was a way I was keeping track of where they were at, and so I knew when they were going to be coming over to, you know, stand around me. But what had happened was when she put that golden veil on the solar menhir, I had this expansion of energy. My heart opened up and popped so much so that I actually had to let out a cough. I was like, "Oh my God!" I thought I was going to pop right up out of off that bench, you know. So they do this several times, and I'm going all the way down through all the chakras, and they get on a lunar gate, and then they go once more around, and the field and vine go, and they stand everybody in a crescent moon around the funeral pier where I'm laying, and they light the torches to illuminate what they couldn't see before in the darkness, which was Baal laying on the funeral bier under a sheet. And then a drum beat sounds, and the Dark Lord Mote comes over, and this was played by Paul Rana, who did a wonderful job. I mean, he came in, and he knew his lines, and he was just really very theatrical, very well-spoken person. And when she pays the final payment of putting the dark veil over his head, that's when I really felt like I came to life. I felt like something that happened where I awoke myself as Baal. And while he's doing the Wicked Witch of the West, and shrinking down under the black veil, and they're starting going, rape him, thresh him, parch him dry, and they're throwing barley at him, you know, and he's dying. I start sitting up, and Astarte comes over and gives me the chalice full of honey mead. And I take a drink, and I get up, and I look down, and I can see the dead mote on the ground, and I've been restored to life, and Astarte's standing there, and all these people are, you know, and I look at him, and I go, I've not been dead, but only sleeping, hardly longer than a wink. I'll be up and rolling thunder once I've had another drink. And then, everybody's laughing and having a good time.
Yeah.
And I stand up, and me and Louise or Baal and Astarte, we take hands, and we hand the chalice over, and we have a kiss of agape. And so Field and Vine take the chalice full of honey mead and the kiss of agape and administer the sacrament to everybody there with the blessings of Baal and Astarte. And once that's finished, they all go back. They went back to the place of assembly, and we closed with a closing pentagram ritual. And it was a really beautiful thing, you know. And the thing that was really profound for me was that, you know, Baal is in the West, which really, you know, it represents the life of man. It's the place of darkness. And
yeah,
this alchemical process of awakening and solution, is very highly symbolic of what is it that you're awakening. It's really awakening in this lifetime your spiritual awareness of who you really are and where you come from in the East, which is, you know, eternity. The process of solution, you know, even the name itself, is solution. There's a solution to your suffering and as waking up, you know. And how do you do that? The goddess comes down. What does the goddess symbolize? She symbolizes love, you know. So it's love that awakens the green man, who's, you know, represented as a symbolic of man himself, and he wakes up to his spiritual nature through an act of love. And to paraphrase W.L. Wilmshurst, you know, there are innumerable paths or methods by which men may be led upward to the spiritual light encircling us all, and in which we live and move and have our being. But that of the three principal methods, the greatest of these, the one that comprehends them all and brings us nearest to heaven, is love. And the full exercise of which godlike virtue, a magician, reaches the summit of his profession, that summit being God himself, whose name is love. And so this act of the God and goddess coming down, resurrecting man in the West to aspire towards the East, especially going through the descent of the spiritual fire, descending down the chakras and activating the spiritual power within humanity, and it awakens them. They're still in their physical state, but they're still in the West, and they have the next challenge coming up in winter solstice, which is based on the dragon of chaos, you know, and we'll learn how that's conquered in next seasonal. But the alchemical, I mean, you think about, you know, the summer solstice, the green man is burnt down to an ash, and the dark lord takes over, and you learn about mortality and how, you know, how much folly life is, and really, like, you know, you can get into the funk of, you know, everyday life. Like, what's the point? You know, it doesn't, you know, just, and big egos, and I'm important, and then, you know, death takes you just like that. But what happens in the autumn equinox is so important, is the awakening of the spiritual side of man, and the aspiration to ascend back to our eternal home. And that's what I get out of it. And after that, we all assembled, and we made a announcement about the Soma Western Mystery Conference that you're going to be coming out to at the end of this month, and talking about your book on Hermetic Yoga. If anybody hasn't heard about this and wants to come hear you speak, or any of the other many speakers that are coming to do this, you can go to austinsoma.org, and the tickets for the Western Mystery Conference are on there. And if you put in I Love Soma, you get a half off discount for that. After we made the Soma announcement, we all wanted to do more magic. Everybody was just so powered up to do this. We had about 12 people that decided they wanted to go in and do a path working in the water element. And so we actually had 12 people poke under that dark mirror, and we went and opened the temple and did the water path working on the path of Quaff, and really connected to the water element and the, you know, which is the element of the autumn season. And everybody really enjoyed that, but you should have seen it. I mean, it was 12 people underneath that suspended mirror. It was pretty crazy. And we were all tired and exhausted after that, but we sure had a really great time. And it sure was fun.
Well, that's really great. Doing a pathworking after that ceremony would you must have. Well, you know, actually, if it's a good ceremony and they're all I don't think we've ever done a really bad one. You get so charged up that you can use that magical energy. And usually what we end up doing is here at Rivendell, what we end up doing is having our feast afterward, and then we'll have a bardic circle. And then whoever wants to present something, you know, on the theme, a poem or a story or something, we have a wonderful lady, Sister Urania, who has is a harpist, and we have one of these little baby harps that we use, and so she accompanies the bardic circle. But the idea of doing a pathwork, well, that's great. I have to say that the idea of Baal lying there, it's been so long since I've actually done Baal. I sort of stage manage, and so consequently, I end up doing Moat for Seven Gates. I end up doing Moat because I can stage manage and just come in as Moat and then get pelted and crawl off and continue to stage manage. I haven't been laying on that bench as Baal for, oh gosh knows, it's been 20 years since I've done that. But I think your idea of the Baal actually having the feeling the centers inside himself come alive as he hears her going around the henge, that's wonderful.
Another thing too is what people, you know, new to this may not realize is that the people participating, even if they don't really, if they're not in an active role, just being there in the circle is a unit. It is a unified energy. Everything that everybody is going through in that ceremony is affecting all of us. And that hinge being connected to nature by bringing in the elements from, you know, various sacred sites around Austin affects a large area of people. So what I really appreciate about what you wrote here is just it's a magical way to bring the power of love into an area, you know, and awaken that spiritual power of love within the people, whether they realize it or not.
Well, I think that we have to give Fred Adams and Svetlana credit for that, for inspiring us originally to do our seasonal ceremonies, and because they did theirs and we participated in theirs, you know, before we finally wrote ours up. And we wrote ours up in 1973 and presented the first one in 1974, and then we've been doing them ever since. But Ferroferia was doing their seasonals, mostly on the cross quarters. They did the cross quarters, we did the quarters. But Fred had the idea of enchanting the whole landform surrounding the area. He was very much a magician of the mesocosm. In other words, he wanted to make all nature surrounding the temple and surrounding the henge as part of the greater temple and sanctify it all. And I think that we got the inspiration for that aspect of our ceremonies from Fred and from Svetlana. These are very, very ancient, even though they're modern versions. of very, very, very ancient themes. I mean, our friends in witchcraft talk about the old religion. Well, all right, this is the oldest religion. I mean,
and by old time religion we mean Canaanite.
Yeah, we mean right, but however, we don't mean to. I don't want people, and I know you don't either. We don't want people to think that we're a counter religion or that we're going against the Bible or anything like that. Actually, the truth of the matter is that the so-called 10 lost tribes of Israel were never lost at all. They just worshipped El instead of YHVH, and they were closer related to the tradition that we've revived. And so we're not against the Bible. We're right in the Bible. We're what's behind the Bible, you know. And we're what the boys in the back room are having. You know?
Right.
and that includes Princess Salome, and includes Solomon, and includes our old friend Shamgar, and there, and all of the Canaanites that were actually and the Samaritans that were actually doing this sort of thing that you don't hear about. And so this is judgy, but it sounds to me like you had a very, very, very deep and fulfilling experience all the way around. And this is what these seasonal ceremonies should be. They should put you into a spiritualization of not only the henge and the hermitage and the temple, but all of the surrounding the ecocosm around you should be enchanted by this.
Bale is awake. We have a storm rolling through right now as we're talking here in Texas. It just rolled right past with, you know, lightning and thunder and wind and rain, and so he has woken up. And one thing I noticed when I moved to Liberty Hill was that we're in a terrible drought, and there was, when I bought my house, there was just dead trees everywhere, and there was no grass. And when we started doing the seasonals, the green started coming back, and the dead trees, we're taking them down, and we have new growth, and we're starting to see a revitalization of the natural surroundings of our area. It's not perfect yet, but it's, you know, the more we do this, I really feel it does change the ecosystem. I really believe that now. When I first started doing the OTA, honestly, folk, you know, I got in because I wanted to do the Goetia, right? And I was like, well, I don't want to do the seasonal. And I was like, why do I want to do that? You know, I don't want to do the Goetia. But, you know, you're like, oh, come on, just try them out, you know, just try it out and see what you think, you know. And I'm like, all right, you know, begrudgingly go out there and do the seasonals. But the more I started doing them, the more I actually started learning about the Tree of Life and how it's connected to nature and my role in place within a very, well, you know, with Kabbalism and Hermetic magic, a lot of it, you know, the modern Hermetic magic is that it's very abstract and it's very intellectual. But when you take it outside into a henge, outdoors, under the stars or under the moonlight, or you're connecting and you're starting to get the ideas that the Kabbalists, I think, originally were trying to get across in an abstract way of what's actually going on. And I was, you know, we were sitting out there, you know, talking, looking at the torchlight and, you know, the altar in the center, and this is all afterwards, but, you know, we come up with ideas, we're like, well, why don't we just do the, you know, the archangel invocations outdoors in the henge instead of in a enclosed space where we're actually, you know, invoking angels right under the stars. And we can actually move this, you know, henge. It's portable. We can move it to any area that we want in nature and be outside and actually experience, you know, an abstract kind of a intellectual style of, you know, artificially constructed ceremony out in nature and actually get the actual meaning, a deeper meaning, you know, behind Kabbalistic and Hermetic magic by performing, you know, our ceremonies under the stars and in the hinge itself, you know, because it's uniting the whole tree of life right around you, you know?
Well, I thought that was a pretty good idea. I'm so glad that you have, you know, come so wonderfully to that revelation. I think that essentially, as far as I was always concerned, the primary purpose of Goetia is to access Baal and Astarte that had been transformed into demons, which they didn't deserve to be at all, and put way down in the bottom of our collective unconsciousness, stuck down there by the priests and the rabbis and all, and to bring them up through the Goetia and bring them up and allow them to once again be the Queen of Heaven and the Prince of Earth, and enjoy this connection with nature and recover what we lost when we demonized when we demonized the old religion, you know,
right.
And we got to remember that even Christianity is as worthwhile as it is, and all of that, and of course we, you know, in the inner order we have Marcosian Hermetic Rosicrucianism, but still, Christianity was a religion that was kind of born out of. Oppressive civilization. It wasn't born out of nature. It was a Gnostic thing like the world is terrible. Let's leave. You know, let's leave and go
right.
Somewhere else. This is not the Hermetic. This is not the Hermetic view. This was a Gnostic view, and Christianity was a Gnostic response. And even though, well, Marcosian Christianity was much more Hermetic, but this is why it's so important to recover our connection with nature. And I got to credit Fred Adams and Svetlana for making me spiritualizing me and Jeanette and the rest of us originally. So we knew what Astarte was and Baal were really all about. Let's put it that way, rather than just a couple of spirits that Solomon managed to use. We realized what the importance of them really was, and you've come to that. You came to that through the same process, and your revelation lying there on the coffin board was, oh boy, that's inspired me now. That's. Every ball that lies there from now on out is going to get me instructed. Now, as they go around, you go ahead and imagine you do your yoga while they're going around and confronting the portal guards, and that should be absolutely.
What was so powerful about this was it wasn't me doing it. It was the power of the ritual. And it was the fact that the goddess really was there, and she was descending down through the spheres, holding that chalice of love, and to awaken her lover that she's been waiting for, you know, like, wake up. It's time to wake up and come home, where it's so far removed. It's just, you know, there's no other place we want to be. You know, we want to be in a state where we get out of ego and we are awakened to a spiritual reality that's connected to nature, and we actually like being here. And we can, through our love, change the people and the places and our connections with our environment just by our state of being. You know, and that's what's beautiful about these seasonals is they do bring that out. And it's so important that if somebody wants to do OTA magic, is that the seasonals are what hold the OTA together. It's not the Goetia, it's not the invocations or the path workings. All of that, I've come to believe, is actually secondary, even because it's personal. That all of that is a personal development system, whereas the seasonal brings community together. It brings your friends and brings the order together, and it gels it. I think you once told me that if it weren't for the seasonals, there might not have been an OTA. I think you told me that once. You remember that?
Yeah, it's true. I was just about at one point, I was feeling really low and I was about to give it up, and my daughter came to me and she said, "Dad," she said, "you can't stop seasonal." She said, "me and my friends, we grew up with them. You can't stop the seasonals." And then, I said, "Okay," you know. So we kept them going, and oh boy, I'm sure glad we did. You know that because they're the heart and soul of what we do.
Yeah, because she loved what you did there. That was the love that in the order that was held together by the seasonal rites, and that's what holds the OTA together, and that's why it's the oldest practicing lodge in the United States, because of the seasonals. They're so important. They're fun to do. They're great to get people together and do things with. And you want to, the more you do them, the more you want to make them better. The more you want to have more elaborate costumes and more, you know, more people to show up and have a bigger feast. And you know, next time we'll do a bardic circle, a big bonfire
but please don't get to where you make them so professional that people that aren't quite ready for prime time don't have a chance to do roles, because we're doing this for ourselves. We're not doing this unless we make a film, which we've done occasionally. But I mean, you know, we want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to enjoy them and enjoy performing at them. For a little while there, we made the mistake of trying to be too professional. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Not everybody is talented at memorization of lines, and not everybody, you know, is comfortable performing in front of people. But you know, there's something about just getting out there with your friends and becoming like a little child and acting and playing, and it's the act of play that brings out that love and camaraderie. And absolutely, last seasonal, we had completely different actors, member initiates that played the roles. Robbie Ramirez and Savannah Smith played a beautiful Field and Vine, and we had Logan Lemieux who played Moat, and we switched the roles around, and it was just a really beautiful thing. And in Winter Solstice, we're gonna have new people playing Tanit and Lotan, and I'm making this Lotan dragon mask out of paper and cloth mache and wire mesh, and it's going to be really elaborate, you know. And so it's just kind of like and another thing that was kind of cool, I have to credit my lovely wife for this, is that I made the hermetic roses to put onto the I painted them, and I was going to put them on the hinge, and I was trying to figure out, like, do I want to nail it, or do I want to, you know, bolt it on there, or what? And my wife comes over, like, "Why don't you just use Velcro?" You know, and I was like, "That's genius, because I can actually take the roses off and use them as panicles for the path working." After we were done with the ritual, we had a fully charged panicle, and we pulled that off the Velcro, and we put it on the dark mirror. And we had a, you know, Annette Zock sphere panicle for our pathworking that was charged from the ritual, which was really cool.
That's great. By the way, next week we're continuing right along with this theme that we're on. Next week we're going to have a show on the really old ancient origins of the Holy Grail. And that, of course, will start with Jesse Weston's From Ritual to Romance, and we'll work it all the way up through Marcus and taking the Grail to Southern France and the whole business. But to solve the if you wonder what happened to the skull of John the Baptist, okay, remember all of this. Well, that shows up in our Halloween ceremony, and as you know, I'm gonna officiate on that one in Austin and in Atlanta, and then Frater Solomon will be doing it here at Mosavad. But that's where the Dark Lord Mote has his, and Halloween is his ceremony, and that's where we bring out that poor old John the Baptist gets a chance to get lubricated and to lubricate everybody else. So we're really looking forward to that, and I'm looking forward to coming your way and doing that one. Also, I want to mention that if people that are listening to this for the first time, you don't have to be a member of the OTA to have our seasonal ceremony book. It's available on Amazon. It's called Seasonal Rites of Baal and Astarte, and you can get it on Amazon. And I know they're in stock, but they just sent a few off. And so, if you want to find out what this is all about, and really kind of get the experience as far as we can put it between two covers, you can order that. And until then, until next week, with the Holy Grail, next week, until then, good magic.